Hello, my name's Bill Cummings, and you're listening to Show Me Magic, a God Is in the TV recommend show.
Hello and welcome to the 12th episode of Show Me Magic, a new music podcast from God Is in the TV zine.co.uk. My name's Bill Cummings, and this week we've got the bloke from Gomez / Broken Record Campaign, Tom Gray, with us.
Hiya, how you doing?
Too bad. How are you, Tom?
Yeah, I'm all right, you know.
Busy?
Yeah, very, very busy. Broken Records keeping me very busy. And I'm also trying to write a lot of music. So, you know, yeah. Left brain, right brain. How about you?
Yeah, not too bad. Lots of podcasts, lots of writing, lots of thinking about things with the world the way it is at the moment. You know, COVID-19, lockdown, Black Lives Matters, all sorts of things on my mind.
It's very much left us in that position, hasn't it? It's very much created. I think it's something to do. It's not just the fact that COVID-19 obviously creates a massive, you know, watershed moment where economically everything seems crazy. But also just the kind of state of anxiety that it creates from being trapped in your house all the time.
Yeah.
I think it is also doing something to our entire mentality, which is very, very interesting. And allows us to think about things that I think sometimes, like, socially we would kind of go, nah, don't be silly, because, like, you know, in social groups sometimes if people start being a bit high-minded and a bit over thoughtful, we tend to go, I'll shut up. But when we're left alone with our thoughts a bit longer, we start to go, you know what, this is fucked, why don't we do something about this?
Yeah. Is that where the Broken Record campaign came from?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, it just came from me ranting on Twitter.
Yeah, I noticed that, yeah.
And then it just, it's a bit like pushing a barrel down a hill, really. I didn't have to do much more than just give it a little push.
That's my gold.
Yeah, there you
Sometimes
go.
Sometimes the best ideas come from sort of an organic place, don't they, like that, anyway?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it'd be a bit disingenuous to say that it's organic, you know. Yeah. The thing is that I've been working, I mean, I'm a director of PRS, work with the Ivors Academy and the MU and the Featured Artists Coalition and all these different, I'm like an advocate for artists and songwriters anyway. I think about this stuff a lot and I'm kind of across it. So sort of find myself in a moment where I can talk about it from a position of not authority, but certainly expertise, and go, this is where everything's sitting. This is how it is. And I can explain it to people simply and educate people and make them think twice about the way things are being done. Then, you know, I kind of felt like I had to do something.
Yeah.
That's really where it came from.
How would you simply describe it then, the Broken Record campaign? Because you had the long list of tweets that
not without getting too lost in the weeds, Broken Record is about the fact that the streaming system and the way that it remunerates artists and songwriters doesn't work for artists and songwriters. It doesn't fund emerging talent. It doesn't fund the regions. It doesn't fund niche music. It doesn't fund classical and jazz. It doesn't fund anything. All it does is it pulls all the money together and sends it off to Los Angeles. And that isn't what the music business ought to do. You know, it needs to care about its own ecosystem. It needs to reflect the fact that it is part of a bigger structural, cultural thing, you know, and kind of, and relate to that and make sense of it. At the moment, it's been the record business lost all of its cash for a long time, found a new way of making money, clawing it all back. Now they're making billions. Both Sony and Universal reported $1 billion takings in the first quarter of this year, in one quarter, $1 billion each. Wow. And most artists, you know, even mid-ranking artists, you know, and even some bigger names on major label deals don't make any money from streaming, and something must be done. It's just as simple as that. And it's like, And the thing is, I know that I'm probably going to fail in the attempt, but if I can educate artists and songwriters about what their rights are and the kinds of deals that they should and shouldn't do, yeah. and give them a real clear picture of the rights environment, I think that's probably a win anyway.
Yeah. Certainly. Do you think that they, you know, that they, some of them should be actually thinking about not putting their stuff up on Spotify? I know obviously it's about getting it out there and it's the biggest player and everyone will post out, you know, their singles on Spotify. This is going to be on Spotify. Save your album on Spotify. But is it just worth, you know, them not doing this as, to make some kind of major movement?
I don't think it's about, I mean, I think that we need to fix the streaming system, which means that we have to pull the levers. We have to get the major labels to sort their face out and redo the licensing deals that we all have to work within. You know, the reason why more money doesn't go to songwriters is because major labels won't let more money go to songwriters in those licensing deals. You know, why only 10% or whatever goes to the song is literally because they're sitting on the lion's share of the money. Mm. So, you know, something has to be done there. When I speak to young artists about what they should do, though, you know, because a lot of young artists come to me and they go, well, you know, fuck Spotify, whatever. And I'm like, well, that really isn't it. But what I will do is give them, I try to give them some really constructive advice, which is, you know, the problem with streaming is right now it doesn't make you any money. Therefore, if you put your music straight onto streaming, it will cannibalize your real fans with passing listeners. Mm. And that is no good to you because you need money for your career. You need to, you know, you need to be able to put, you know, fuel in your van. You need to be able to get that microphone fixed. You need to be able to do things. You need to be able to invest in your own work. So to get anywhere, you know, you've just, you've got to have the means. And so what I say is think about the sort of analogy I use is like hardback, paperback lending library, because people understand that. Mm. And it's like physical sales are hardback, right? So and you're going to make the most money out of that. So if you can direct to your fans to get, you know, to get the real fans to buy in first. If you put it on streaming too soon, they're not going to do that. They're not going to buy the physical. So it has to stay in the physical world for a lot longer than it presently is doing before it goes anywhere. Mm. Then go to paperback, which is Bandcamp, and put your music up there. And try and monetize it there for as long as possible before you then go to Spotify.
Yeah, that's right.
And which is the lending library.
Mm.
And you know, don't get any, once it's gone on there, you're not going to make any money.
Yeah.
And so, you know, maybe you need to put one or two tracks on Spotify to kind of get to tastemakers.
Promotion,
Promotion and radio play. But do not think that you have to get everything on there. And there's also this weird culture around Spotify where people think, oh, I've got to make a new track and then I've just got to get it out into the world as quickly as I possibly can because the systems are there for me to do that. Yeah. And it's like, that isn't helping anybody. That is just making a giant landfill of music that nobody listens to.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what the percentage of tracks is on Spotify that only ever has one listen, but it's almighty.
Yeah. Right?
And people always go, oh, the value of music's always going to go down because people are just making so much more music. And that isn't really true. The amount of music that people are listening to at any one time is relatively finite based on the number of people who have subscriptions and how much music they can listen to in the time that they have. So that is a misconception. I mean, there's a little bit of truth to it, but basically it's false. So, you know, don't just keep chucking music out there. Think about what you're doing with it. Yeah. Think about retaining value, retaining, and also, you know, quality control. Which is the big thing that I think gets lost in all this. If you can just put stuff out all the time, you know.
Yeah. There does seem to be like a fear of being forgotten about if you're not on streaming platform all the time. It's something new, isn't there?
Mm.
It does seem to be a new thing where artists feel like they need to have new releases ready to go all the time. It's just
feed the beast.
Yeah.
But I think that's to do with social media.
Visibility. Visibility. Yeah,
exactly. And I think there's a lot of pressure put on young artists, especially by management, to have this constant presence. And it's not good for your mental health. And B, I just don't think it necessarily helps. I don't think there's much evidence for that. I think having a presence, being out there, having, you know, committing to a certain amount is a great idea, but that 24/7, 365 new music thing is just, well, I mean, where is that going to get you? That's just going to get you a nervous breakdown.
Yeah. Yeah.
You ask me.
No, it's a real danger, isn't it? You know, mental health is a big thing, you know. I've written about it quite a lot, you know.
Especially with young artists who I speak to now.
Yeah.
Like, that it is rife, you know. And it was always a problem because we put ourselves out there and we have to dig into these sort of deep emotional places to make work and think about things like that and put a lot of pressure on ourselves to basically be imaginative and have the next brilliant idea. But that's just unrealistic. Mm. No, you're just who you are. Just do stuff when you can, you know.
Yeah. We'll start with a bit of new music then. Sorry, swiftly moving on.
You start me off. Start me off and I don't stop.
So. No, it's a very interesting overview, you know. Yeah, go a bit more into it because some of the subjects you've touched on there, we've kind of touched on in previous podcasts. Even yesterday, we were talking about the devaluation of music and how releases don't have that kind of cultural impact they used to have, and various issues spanning from, you know, streaming culture, I guess, that you've talked about there. Yeah. We go into as we go along. But your first track, Tom, that you've chosen for us?
My track that I've chosen for you is Willie J. Healy, True Stereo.
Phone talk in the evening.
like the sort of looseness of it, and it got, I was getting like a sort of 60s, almost psychedelic feeling from it. I was also getting like echoes of like Paul McCartney and T-Rex and stuff like that. Interesting.
All of that. It felt like he's just living his best life. And that's the kind of music that I like to listen to. Is somebody who sounds like they don't care. And he just sounds like he's having a joyful, blissful time making his music. I don't know what he's into. The thing is, I just stumbled across this track by accident and didn't realize what it was or where it was coming from. And then I listened to a load of his other work and I really like him. I think he's great. And then I discovered he's on Yala Records, which my mate Felix White from the Maccabees. And I texted him and I was like, oh, I've just heard this lad. And he's like, oh, yeah.
I was like, I know all about him. I
feel like a right dickhead because I've only just realized. I just thought it felt like actually there might be a summer in this when I heard this track.
Yeah.
Summer might arrive. Well, we've had a bit of it the last few weeks. So
to stop today.
Yeah.
That is it. I love the sound of the bass guitar and the percussion track. And it felt very like, oh, I've not, this is interesting that this is music's being made like this. You know.
Well, that's it. When I was listening to it, I was thinking, I've heard a bit of him before, and I think I've even heard this track before as well. But it's good that it's this album he's been playing, because I initially, when I first heard him, and it's almost taken it by his name as well, that he did come from the States and he did come from the South or something like that. And there is that element. I sort of thought it was more like a sort of 70s American Southern States country rock sort of thing. But then there's also elements, I can sort of hear Talking Heads, David Byrne in there, and also a bit of Bowie. Some of the acoustic of it made it sound a bit like Starman. So it's kind of this weird melting pot. And it's like, he just doesn't care. Like you said, he doesn't care what he's doing. He's not trying to be cool. He's not trying to sound like what's now. He's just doing what he wants to do. And that's what I really like about it.
Yeah, but I reckon there's a bit of early Dire Straits in him as well, and kind of Romeo and Juliet vibes about him. It just tickled me. I just really liked it, and I was just like, I hope kids are all just making music for the hell of it.
Yeah. Well, that's it. There are a lot of bands coming out at the moment that aren't sort of having that idea where they've listened to a lot of stuff. I mean, they've gone and investigated themselves, because some of them were born in the late 90s now, so we're all way older than them. So even their parents weren't listening to stuff from the 60s and 70s necessarily. So they're all maybe just about. But so they're now listening to and delving down, and there's even like bands like Sorry. They've got such a weird palette that they've gone from. They did a thing on Rough Trade where they chose a load of records and nothing was like recent. There was nothing really particularly new. It was all either there was like 80s dance stuff, there was 60s girl groups, there was 70s prog and stuff like that. And there was such a huge difference. So I think the kids a lot of these days are almost rebelling against that kind of concept of cool to a certain degree and are just doing whatever the hell they want. And it's really refreshing.
It's very Gomez. I like it. It is
very Gomez, yeah.
It's very Gomez. It's like, yeah, cool is not going to get you anywhere.
Not anymore. Cool's going to get you in 5 minutes.
Yeah, well, exactly. I think it's brilliant that obviously this is why streaming is so important. It gives you so much access to music. I remember it took like about a year to get a hold of a copy of Star Sailor by Tim Buckley, and it was very disappointing when I got it. But it took me about a year to get hold of a copy, right? And I think that, you know, obviously some people go, oh, isn't it sad that we've lost that kind of the great search for the missing record?
The effort, and that
kind of like, oh my God, what is this? And it was out of print and blah blah blah. But at the same time,
you know,
being able to just go ding, click, you know.
Well, that's it, isn't it? Convenience often trumps everything, and that is about streaming, isn't it, in a way? Convenient, really. Like I was saying to Jim about download, because we often download a lot of the tracks on this and buy them, you know, but we often have hassle doing that, don't we, Jim? You just say to me, oh, you know, streaming is just so much easier, and unfortunately it is, even though I still buy records and I love it. Listening to physical records is just the ultimate to me. But ultimately, streaming is so easy, you know, especially YouTube as well. And you, I've noticed you've mentioned YouTube about being one of the worst in terms of
YouTube.
Its YouTube rates and stuff. You know?
Yeah, no, they're awful, mate. They're really, really awful. I mean, we had a big piece. We worked for months and months. Loads of us went to Brussels and to get this copyright directive through. Right, that basically was going to force Google out of this thing they called this thing they use called Safe Harbor, which allows them to basically it's not their responsibility if people put music on their platform. Therefore, they don't have to financially have anything to do with it. Right, and they've gotten away with that for years and years. It was brought in at the very beginning of the internet to basically allow, you know, startup companies to not have to, you know, worry about licensing, but this basically, you know, you now have the biggest company in the world still using this
loophole
to not pay for money. And basically the copyright directive closed that down. Right. And now we're leaving the EU. And Boris has, despite the Tories backing the copyright directive, he's now run away from it because part of their plan post Brexit is to just try and get Google and Amazon to move to London. And that's basically their whole economic plan because they're idiots. Brilliant. And that's really it. Turn us into a tax haven and get the big tech to move here. And from Luxembourg and Dublin. So they're the worst. They don't pay anything. And there's a crazy thing whereby hopefully it won't happen, but there's a danger at the moment that British songwriters' music on YouTube might be worth up to 40% less than our European counterparts.
Wow.
Because we haven't absorbed that piece of legislation into our own, you know.
What happened to YouTube Music? What happened to that? Because it didn't seem to take off.
I'm sure they're still trying to do that. You know, I'm sure they've still got some kind of thing going on. I mean, the main thing is that they make loads of money and they could just give it to musicians.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, really not complicated. YouTube, about 75% of YouTube is music. Of the things that people actually watch on it are music.
Very bad sound, very badly recorded music as well.
Exactly right. So you've got a platform built on music. That just mines it of all of its value to keep people in and to sell advertising and doesn't give any of it back. And that's the problem.
Yeah. Okay. we'll go into other aspects of that, I'm sure, as we go along. I just better give a score to this. We give a mark out of 10 as well. I forgot to tell you that, Tom.
Really? I've got a mark it.
You could participate if you like.
I'm giving it a solid 8. It's a solid 8.
Okay. Yeah. Jim?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. 8, yep.
I'm going for your weasel score of 7.5. I did enjoy it. It reminded me of other bands like Buzzard and Boys Uguru, sort of local to me at the moment, who were sort of really into that kind of 70s, you know, and the way they attack it is with kind of real glee and imagination, you know, so I did enjoy it.
And there's touches of that sort of Matthew E. White kind of production going on as well.
Yeah. Jim, your first track this podcast?
Sorry, my first track is by Hannah Georgias, and it's That Emotion. Play it till I kill it, just to get it in my head. I want another secret, where you been hiding? Yeah, 'cause I'm trying. Say it, big plans that you've been making.
I really love that. And I was actually going to pick that for another podcast as well. And I really love her vocals. They're very soothing. And it kind of skips along with pattering drums and glowing keyboards. Sorry, doing all my music journalism here. Yeah, I really love it. And it's sort of emotive and it swells up beautifully. And I think she toured with The National, didn't she, Jim?
Yeah, well, she's under the wing of Aaron Dessner. She produced it, and I think he might even do a bit of the writing with her, or at least certainly aid her on that. She's from Toronto, so it's not like they're sort of like city buddies or anything like that. But this just came to me from one of the regular PRs who I talk to quite often, who usually sends over good stuff. But and this was almost a bit of a break from the relentless post-punk, which I keep saying week after week recently now, that I keep getting sent all that, and it gets a bit tedious at the moment. I just don't feel like we need that kind of thing at the moment. We need something a bit more soothing, a bit more calming. And this certainly fits the bill. I think it's from her new album, or debut album, I think, All That Emotion, which will be out fairly soon. I don't think they specify when it's going to be out. Obviously, things are still a bit up in the air about when things are going to get released and hopefully not just stream the hell out of it, as we were just talking about. But yeah, she's got a really lovely voice. And some of the styles on different songs are quite different. But yeah, there's very much that kind of brooding piano that he does with The National really well. So there's sort of quite heavy elements of that, which you would expect if he's producing it. But yeah, with added, with her voice, yeah, it's just really beautiful. I've got the album, so I'm going to delve into that soon.
Cool. What did you think, Tom, that one?
It's really lovely. Really.
Yeah.
I'm a bit worried when anyone says that somebody's under the wing of like a male.
Well, yeah.
I'm like,
you need to be careful.
I don't, that's giving me the shivers already, but I mean, I'm sure she's her own woman. I think there's quite a few really great women singer songwriters at the moment, and who are kind of playing acoustic music and it's working, and it's really refreshing to hear it again.
It feels
like that's kind of got, I mean, obviously you've got like Phoebe Bridges and that lot. And I was saying on you the other day to a mate that I'm just really glad that it's happening again, because you need this kind of music, you know.
Exactly.
You're a big fan of Laura Marling, aren't you, Jim?
I am, yeah. No, she's a goddess as far as I'm concerned. She's very independent and does a lot of most things herself. The only reason I said about it, Underwing, is because he produced that. It's coming out on his Brassland Records label. So,
I know, I was only teasing you, mate.
I know. I appreciate that.
No, you have got to be careful these days, Jim.
Well, exactly. When you mentioned Phoebe Bridges, of course, there's the whole Ryan Adams issue and things like that. So, no.
I was hinting at that. I think we have to, the way that we frame these things, we have to talk about it differently now. But like, obviously, he's heavily involved. She's ace. I think she's going to do very well, and I'll be listening to her a lot in my house. Laura Marling, on the other hand, I haven't listened to the new record yet, and I'm quite ashamed about that because I love
it. Highly recommend it.
You were talking about, like, you work with a lot of newer acts and stuff, like giving them advice and things like that, and in your various roles. how easy is it to like break an artist these days? You know, you talk about streaming and stuff like that, and it seems to be really hard work. You know, you have to put in a lot of hard
work. I think your perception on it is exactly right. I mean, it's really, really tough. And I think emerging talent have the hardest time of it in any way. And obviously, with small clubs being gone now, I think they're the ones that are going to find it hardest of all. Yeah. Because I'm really worried about a bit of a lost generation, actually. Mm. Because, you know, without being able to play gigs and to kind of keep that spirit of like, what keeps you together as a group of musicians when you're young? I mean, what's going to keep you together? I mean, if you haven't got access to like recording facilities and stuff like that, I mean, depends. I mean, maybe people will be all right, but I am worried. Tough. I am worried.
Yeah. There are various schemes and things like that, but It is hard. It is hard. And it kind of creates like a two-tier system, doesn't it? It's like the haves and the have-nots, and then the people in the middle as well. The people in the middle in the 90s or the 2000s might have had a label behind them, whereas now you can actually fund them, whereas now it's a lot harder. You know, even if you're on a label, like I was reading and like you've said, you know, a lot of things cost a lot, you know, touring costs, you know, recording costs, you know, and where's the income coming in, you know? So...
Oh no! Well,
we need to rethink things, don't we? I guess.
Well, I mean, it's just that there's enough money in the system.
But yes,
it's just all aimed in the wrong place.
Yeah, that's true.
Taylor and Ed don't need more money, and you know, Universal and Sony don't need more money. Their shareholders might not think that, but it's self-evident when you look at their books that they don't need any more money.
There's things like Spotify paying for a high-profile podcast and things like that, you know, millions of pounds.
I mean, that was just loathsome, wasn't it? We're paying $100 million for a podcast. And what's that? Where's that $100 million come from? I think someone did a calculation, which that was 37 billion streams.
Wow.
Wow.
That's the value, which is, I mean, that must be a lot of the totality of every listener that's ever been on.
Yeah.
I can put my hand up here and say I've never heard of the guy either.
I know he's massive. My brother.
I've watched a few things on YouTube. I mean, he's very popular with sort of like these clips, you know.
Not saying that to sound like.
And he's one of these people who sort of like puts himself up as like man of the people. You know, I speak my mind and all that kind of stuff.
He's
I mean, some of the guests he has on are interesting, but they're like four-hour podcasts, and who's got the time to invest in a four-hour podcast? I don't know.
The weird thing is that he's into like selling like weird drinks that make you stronger or something as well. And he's got like a weird sideline in
white protein,
like shilling some kind of weird thing. And he owns the company and he gets his guests to talk about it as well. It's like, what? It's creepy. I don't like it.
Placement in podcasts. Now that is a dystopian future. I don't want to see.
Happens in a lot, Jim. We're small beer, mate. We haven't got any.
Don't say beer.
Yeah.
There is a company called Small Beer, isn't it?
Yeah. There is.
So, probably. I mean, maybe should we just keep saying the name and see if
you get a caseload set.
Anyway, Hannah Georgias. What are we going to give her? I mean, anyway, we've gone off on a tangent again. We like to do that. I'm going to give that an 8 because I really like that.
Yeah, Jim, me too.
Tom.
It soothes my soul on my walk today in the drizzle, and so I'm going to give it a 9.
Lovely. Ooh, excellent. Yeah. No, it is. It's a really great track.
Yeah.
And it kind of stuck with me as well. Okay, moving on to my track. This is a new one from Tugboat Captain, and this is No Plans, brackets, for this year.
Plans for this year, yet. plans for this year. Yes. Yes.
Tugboat Captain and a London five piece who sort of, they played a Balcony Fest set for us, which is an online streaming festival that's been going on. We've been supporting Tom, picking some acts for and, you know, promoting some artists and stuff. They're quite indie pop. And I like this one because it's got the brass and it kind of swells, but there's also a kind of tongue in cheek quality to the title as well that I quite like. And yeah, it's not entirely serious, but it kind of gave me a good feeling, so I thought I'd pick it.
It kind of sort of brought to mind something like a Divine Comedy, a Neil Hancock lyric and type of thing. But also, whereas he's a bit more kind of cheeky and was like that whole Alfie thing, and sort of he's from Northern Ireland, but he almost seems to come across as sort of a London sort of thing. But
I think they're based in London.
Also a certain element of sort of maybe Belle and Sebastian, and also a bit of sort of Gorky's I Got a Minky as well.
I thought Boo Radley's, and then I thought, and you know, all the things that you mentioned, it reminds me of a certain sort of moment in sort of 90s indie when it was sort of a bit day glow. I'm never a massive fan of the descending bass line called just get bigger and bigger.
It is quite simple. It's quite
simple. As long as they're not a one trick pony, I don't mind.
No, they've had quite a few. They're quite prolific, really. They're quite an indie pop band, and they've released quite a few singles. So
I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the Bowie esque drop down to piano 2/3 of the way through. That was a straight kind of move from Hunky Dory kind of vibe. And it was joyful. It definitely was joyful. And you're right. I thought the lyric was hilariously appropriate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Was it done in lockdown? Was it a written in lockdown thing, or was it just another coincidence?
I think it's a single coming out at the end of this month. So yeah, I think it's probably around now. They had another one, which I really like. Be Strong, Smoke Less. It was like a sort of advice from his mum, you know, because he was feeling depressed. And that's quite a good one as well. Yeah, so I do like them. They're quite cheeky, you know.
I like a bit of wit. It's good.
They're a fun band, and I think they're quite like DIY, really. So I thought I'd put them
on. It's a hell of a production number as well. I had a bit of problems with their bass drum, but other than that,
it's good fun.
It's pretty glossy, mate, actually.
Mm. We've been asking everyone this, but when do you think touring will resume of any, you know, great note?
I forgot, mate. I'm really not hopeful about that. Not until everyone's inoculated,
you know,
or whatever. It's going to take a long time. And I think a lot of, yeah. I think a lot of gigs are going to go out of business before then. And then that once people get back on the road, and this is the thing that nobody thinks about, and I keep sort of, because it's just like a really boring technicality of the live world. The way that live works is bands compete for the same rooms on the same nights with promoters, right? And then somebody wins it, and it's usually the person who can charge the most money and can sell the most tickets, and they'll win the room, right? Because the room will get paid the highest fee for that. Yeah. So when they actually allow this to happen again, there's going to be a load of acts who can't actually get in the rooms anyway, because everyone's going to be competing for the same rooms. Right. So you've got this massive delay whereby it takes a long time to plan a tour anyway. So you've got to know when you can do it.
Yeah.
And then you've got to compete for the rooms. All of this adds an enormous time and planning element onto whatever you think the picture is. I mean, I'll be really happy if we manage to have the festivals next year, basically.
Yeah, that's what we're hearing. Yeah, that's what we think. I mean, there has been talk of some kind of like in Europe sort of socially distanced gigs, but I just don't see how it works. And like you said, how do you plan for that? You know, you have to sort of book it way in advance and stuff.
I've not read them yet, but I think the WHO put out some guidelines on mass attendance things today. I've got to read it.
Okay.
But it might be worth putting our eyes on that. But I don't think it's going to be great news for people trying to organise performances. I mean, and of course, we've got a much higher R rate than all these other countries. So I mean, I heard
that's right.
I believe Denmark just managed to actually put on a gig. I don't know how far away we are from
A long way away from it. Yeah.
Yeah.
There seems to be a bit of an illusion at the moment, doesn't it? It's like they're opening up, but there's still things haven't actually changed materially that much, you know.
Well, that's it. I'm still finding it quite strange. There's still like tours and things that were meant to be happening sort of sporadically throughout the past 3 months, and they've pushed a lot of bands sort of very early doors in March, pushed things to only like July, and there's still stuff outstanding that's meant to be happening in July, and they still haven't been pushed back yet. And it's like, I don't know why everyone just didn't sort of give it a bit of a rest and try and wait it out. And like you said,
that might be commercial reasons that they don't want to
get into the room. It's difficult to try and book it for another time, and it was just maybe the most convenient thing. But it's
can't afford to refund everyone, you know.
Well, that's it, yeah. And it's when they can eventually get into the room that they were meant to in the first place, I suppose.
Yeah.
Anyway, Tugboat Captain.
Tugboat Captain. Yes.
I'm going to give an 8 because you know I picked it. Jib.
7.5.
I'm going to give it a 7.
So over to you, Jim, for a classic.
My long-lost classic is the Cooper Temple Clause and Let's Kill Music. So does everyone remember the Cooper Temple Claws?
I played a gig in Germany, an outdoor gig with Cooper Temple Claws, which was attended by about 12 people. I forget which city it was in. They weren't very happy that day, Cooper Temple Claws. They needed to cheer up a little bit. But, you know, they seemed like nice enough lads.
Yeah, they were sort of relatively sort of local to where I'm from. They sort of formed in Reading, and in fact, even closer, they sort of apparently their place of origin is Wokingham, which is where my my day job office is when we ever get the opportunity to go back. But yeah, so it's kind of one of those bands that was sort of made it big, that was sort of fairly local, and it was sort of a little buzz comes around sort of areas and things like that. But it was one of these bands that I really liked at the time, and I was in Southampton at university, and I remember bunking off work to go and get the album and writing a review and sending it into NME, and their deputy editor sending back saying thanks but no thanks, but it was kind of quite encouraging. But the album it sort of sounds a little bit dated. It was sort of 2002, but some of the singles really stand out still, and this is the first single that I remember hearing, and it's just quite it's a bit more fast paced compared to some of the other stuff on the album, See Through This and Leave, but it's got one of those, it's got quite a churning sort of dancey rhythm to it that sort of makes you think of the music as well, as in the band, the music, Take the Long Way and Walk It. They're kind of like an indie disco sort of staple, if but I don't even remember necessarily being in the indie discos around the time. But yeah, it was just sort of my favorite from the time, and I go sort of looking back over the past sort of however many weeks we've been in lockdown now, looking at older albums that I haven't listened to for a long time, and this sort of stuck out still, this song.
Yeah, I quite liked it. I mean, it's that kind of whirling dervish of guitars and keyboards, isn't it? I mean, I remember the first album, but I was never really into them. I just remember the name being around and thinking the name was funny. I don't even know what it means to this day, to be honest.
It's the Cowper Temple Clause, which was something to do with that in education law back in the 30s, I think it was. Okay. So it's kind of a play on that.
What do you think, Tom?
That's remarkably more intellectual than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
having met the lads.
There are many intellectuals in Reading.
I'm sure there are. This would not have been my bucket of mud back then, or really now. Yeah. I mean, I fully get why this exists. Yeah, it doesn't rock my boat. I struggle with what the emotional content is of this kind of music. I kind of get that you're young and you're male and you want to make some noise. That's what I get from it. Yeah. And that's just about where it stops. And then I'm like, what
it's
else?
It's a bit too obvious, kind of kicking against the jam sort of thing. You know, people who probably, you know, kicking out against the charts and mainstream music, and they're not really believing anything they're saying as well. Of course you don't really. None of those believe what they're singing either. They're just making money out of it. So it's like, you know, it's a bit of an obvious dig out, but you know.
No, I mean, but that's fine. It has its place, you know what I mean? It's just not my couple. No, you know, it's not my thing. It's like, I like stuff that kind of takes that idea and flips it on its head. That would be more interesting to me, you know.
Yeah.
It's too straight ahead for me.
Yeah. Exactly. It had a bit of sarcasm and irony, maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd forgotten it already, to be honest.
I like the more than anything.
I'm sorry, I'm being a bit harsh here, aren't I? But...
No, that's fine. You normally are, Bill, it's fine. Once you get to the end and you've got all the three different types of like vocals and stuff, it gets a bit more, you know, I quite like that, and it was quite interesting the way
it just sounded like a sort of a swirling, I couldn't really, like Tom said, I couldn't really get a handle on any of it. You know, maybe they were good live. I don't know.
If I was on speed and I was 19, I could probably get with it. You know,
a lot of it's about mood, isn't it? Like what hits you in the mood with it. You know?
No, it's mainly about the amphetamines, I think.
Anyway, I'm gonna be quite kind and say a 6.
Ooh.
Jim.
A 7.5 for me. I still enjoy it. It's a nostalgic thing, you know that.
If I was on speed, a 6. Yeah.
But you're not, so I'll fight.
Sorry.
Go back to your campaign. What's the next step? What's the next step?
Free speed for all. No, it's not. it's you know, we're in for the long haul and it's about obviously there's a massive public conversation to be had with consumers about what happens to their money and how it doesn't go to the music that they listen to, and about how you know, how important music is in our country and in our culture, and how we can protect that without letting all of the money just be extracted. And it, basically for me, it's about getting artists to be interested and to sort of take up the cause, having that the conversation with songwriters and composers, and getting them to use their networks to educate people and talk about it. And then, you know, there's a sort of much wider part to this, which is to do with, you know, legislation and regulation and what is possible and viable in order to get to sort of use levers of power to get, you know, get these big corporations kind of brought to heel a bit.
Yeah. That'll take a lot of work, a lot of pressure and awareness spreading. Yeah. And I suppose it comes from below sometimes, doesn't it? Like if you push these big tech giants a bit, then they will respond. You know, they changed something, didn't they, with the donate button or whatever to a charity or.
But
that was kind of a sop, wasn't it? But
it was the worst. Yeah. Like keep the money if you want, but do you want to give it to your favorite charity?
Yeah.
It's like
kind of a face saving thing, really. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's like, there's so much they could do. It's the same with, you know, I mean, like, to be frank, you know, the same with like Warner's announcing this 100 million they're going to give to like black awareness and charities and stuff. It's like they could tomorrow Warner Music could forgive historical debt from the music that they've released throughout the 20th century, and more money would flow back into the black communities overnight than anything else that they could do regarding philanthropy or. Yeah. You know, it's always the same shit. It's like, come on, if you're gonna talk about this stuff, if you genuinely want to do something, do something, but don't pay it lip service and don't make it about you and charity. It's not.
Yeah.
These are people who worked and are craftspeople who work their lives to make beautiful things. You know, it's a job. It's a bloody vocation, actually, and a compulsion. We as listeners know that the value of music is higher than what they put on it.
It's like when you ask people, would you pay a bit more even sometimes? And they're just like, yeah, we would if the music we love got, you know,
more, of course. I mean,
better recompense.
I mean, you've heard me say it, you know, it's the just by keeping the price at $9.99 since 2008 has suppressed the value of music by 26%.
And who wouldn't?
It's incredible, really.
£1.50 for a track, you know, or something like that.
I know, it makes no fucking sense. Netflix have raised the price about 20 times.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. I mean, Netflix have taken a much different approach. They actually, you know, put money into films. I mean, that's a whole other discussion, but they are a different kind of company, aren't they?
Yeah, Spotify were getting up to that. They were making their own music and playlisting their own music. And now there's this whole thing with Spotify for Artists where they're actually getting payola. They're getting people to pay to get put on playlists. And that's really bad. And actually, probably that's what something that actually needs to be regulated against, because it's money for access, which isn't a level playing field. And means that, you know, we've had it bad enough for years in this country that we get to the point where literally every musician you meet is middle class or upper middle class.
Yeah.
And now we're introducing a system where you can only succeed if you pay even more money. It's like, I'm sorry, we've got to do something about it.
Well, yeah. We discussed about Bandcamp, haven't we? And whether or not that could be utilized greater to, because it's great as it is, but you feel like it's almost still a little bit too underground almost, and it could be being utilized so much better because it's such a great platform and there's not much like it really.
Yeah. I mean, I have quite a hard time. So a lot of like startups and kind of alternative methods have been getting in touch with me, and they all want to talk about their kind of way of solving the problem. But what doesn't really get dealt with is the wider global licensing market, which is incredibly complex.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't want to get too into the weeds here, but basically a lot of the deals and the sort of structures that are there that cause the sort of systemic problems that we have, you need a much grander solution than a nice little platform or a nice little app. Yeah. You know, it has to be a big solve. It has to have fundamentals to do with the way that the streaming platforms do deals with major labels, and fundamentals to do with how money gets paid to performers and how money gets paid to writers. That's really the only thing there is. Everything else is just window dressing.
Right. Yeah, it's got to be a sort of systemic change.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's
yeah, because a lot of these deals were sort of signed and stuff like that in the 90s, when then there were a lot of the bands that ended up on Spotify. And then they've been sort of carried on over the time. Because I remember Jeff Barrow tweeting years ago saying, you know, how little he was getting from Spotify. And they had, like Portishead, had millions of streams. So,
yeah, well, I mean, you know, Gomez has probably never made any money from streaming because, you know, we're still in a pre-2001 record contract.
Well, that's it, isn't it? These long deals that didn't even envisage this future, you know?
So. Oh, yeah, and they can't, and you can never, and they'll never, and you can't really account for it, and you can't audit for it, and you can't, you are forever kept in an unrecouped debt, which you can't really see what builds the debt either. So you don't, I mean, I'm not doing this for me, because I don't feel like I've got any skin in the game, but like and I don't care. The reason why we have to fix this is not because of all the old shit deals. I mean, they should be forgiven anyway. And most independent labels actually did forgive a lot of debt when they, at a certain point in history, and the majors just didn't follow suit. They just decided not to because it was making them too much money. Yeah. And that should, you know, that's something that needs to be dealt with. But the bigger story is how damaging this is to culture, and how damaging it is for emerging talent, and how damaging it is for, you know, just art in general and cities. And there is no upside to the way that it is working. The only people it helps are shareholders in major labels.
Yeah.
Goldman Sachs, basically.
It's an example of capitalism, sort of inequality of capitalism, massively.
It's capitalism that, it's stupid capitalism, basically.
Yeah.
You know, capitalism can be fine. It's just, this is just dumb. And it's get rich quick capitalism. It's short termism. It's myopic. And it doesn't have, it's without any consideration for sustainability in the true sense, in terms of keeping a sort of ecosystem alive that is self-sustaining and can keep bringing new talent through and can keep making great stuff and can, you know, that's at some point the music business just forgot what its job was. They just, I think at the point at which they just became data aggregation firms and
yeah, stats and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And
just, it's funny. I know this is like a sort of an off point, but I was thinking about the charts the other day, and a couple of campaigns or people I've known who've been involved in campaigns, like the Jarvis one last year. Yeah. And he was telling me that they sold 22,000 downloads at one point. And because he said the way that the chart is made up now is more, they'll take a gauge at certain points, periods of time, of who's streaming, how many people are streaming, how many downloads you've got, what's your visibility, aggregation, you know, sort of stats and stuff. He said because of that, it only sort of scraped sort of top of the 40s or whatever. But he said if it had been another point, it might have been number two. So I just thought to myself, the whole chart, I mean, I know people don't really care as much about charts anymore, but it is a reflection of streaming, isn't it, in a way, because the streaming culture, because it's that kind of disconnect between, you know, how we used to consume music and how we consume music now.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, mate. There's so many analogies and snapshots and things that affect the way that our culture works that we don't even realize. We think things are more straightforward than they are. You know, it's like the way that, like, you know, the way when people learn how streaming actually works, where all money gets thrown in a big pot and then divided up based on market share, on consumption share.
That's right.
But you kind of go, wait a minute. So of my £7 for music, if I listen to 500 tracks, at least £5 is going to music that I don't listen to.
Mm.
Right? And you kind of go, wait a minute. So what music am I funding? I mean, you could be funding anything. Where's your moral right there? Your money could literally be going to fascist punk. And you don't know it.
Mm. Yeah, and that's particularly, you know, relevant in these times where everyone's very concerned about, you know, where their money's going, or they say they are on social media. It's
this is why it goes so deep to the argument about sustainability and about the relationship between the consumer and their choices. If you're gonna say streaming is a sale, which is what the record companies have done from the beginning, yeah. and said it's not a broadcast or making available or whatever.
Yeah.
No, it patently is. That if you're gonna say it's a sale, well, give the consumer that consumer relationship between their money and their music, so that they
it's a contradiction, isn't it?
Yeah. It is a contradiction. Because I've got moral rights over what my when I go to a shop, I've got moral rights over what I spend my money on. But I lose them as soon as I go on a streaming site. I'm giving money to, you know, it doesn't bother. I mean, there's worse things in the world than to be giving money to Taylor Swift, but I'd rather not.
Yeah.
When she's got a lot of money already,
Well, exactly.
Anyway, we've got two more tracks. I better just squeeze them in. Good chat, though. Interesting chat. Long Blondes. This is Giddy Stratospheres, the original version.
Chocolates, drink your
was one of the singles, early singles that the Long Blondes released in the so like 2000-2006 time. I was really into this band, and I've always felt they were kind of like a little bit underrated, really. I think they were critically, they did quite well.
They
didn't do as well as sort of like the Arctic Monkeys and all the other bands, even like the, you know, the bands you were talking about last week, Jim, Bromhead's Jacket and Milburn and all those ones that came out of Sheffield afterwards in the sort of mid-2000s. But I always liked them because they were kind of artful, and it's all about like kitchen sink romance. And, you know, I like the way she inhabits characters, a bit like Pulp in a way. And this one, I always loved it just because of the guitars, that kind of tremolo guitar and the kind of television, but also a television-y kind of post-punk rhythm as well. I think it's kind of a shame what happened to them because they only released two albums, and then Dorian, the guitarist, had a stroke. So they couldn't fulfill the promise that they had. But they had like a run of singles before the album even came out, and this was one of them. And they re-recorded it for the album, but I prefer the original version. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, I listened to both versions because you said that when you said that there's two different versions, and this is definitely the better version. And it's a little bit faster, not hugely, but that's that little bit faster. It makes it a bit more urgent, a bit more interesting. And initially, when I first listened to it, I thought, yeah, this is quite nice. I remember the Long Blondes, Kate Jackson's, you know, she's a really very cool front woman. She's that really good lyricist and everything. She said about as well. And I thought, it's all right. Yeah, I thought, oh, it might be a bit long. And then I just ended up like listening to it several times over today. And the fifth time I listened to it today, I now absolutely love it. And I didn't know it before. It's kind of weird. She's got such an interesting vocal on this as well. I was sort of trying to sort of pick who she sounded like. And I know we do pointless comparisons on here, but I kind of got this weird, you know, sort of Joanne Catherwood and Susan Ann Scully from Human League, sort of crossed with Kate Bush. There's this kind of sort of almost operatic, not operatic, theatrical kind of thing to her vocals. I sort of really liked it. I thought there was sort of an element of Blondie about the whole thing, a little bit, that kind of sort of rhythmic to it.
It's not really typical of their other stuff, but...
No, exactly. It's not. I don't think I'd ever heard this one before. Certainly not as like a single version or anything. May have heard it live and I've sort of seen them before. But no, I would say this is a definition of a grower, and I love it now.
What do you think, Tom?
I'm glad it's a grower because I don't think I really took to it. I think it reminded me of more sort of Naive Times, and I was surprised it was made as late as 2006. And I remember them being talked about a lot and being like another Sheffield band and all that.
Yeah.
I had lots of connections with the Sheffield scene. So I was kind of like, oh, right, you know. There's something about her vocals, sort of slightly nasally, kind of Saint Etienne-y kind of, something else. I couldn't really kind of put my finger on it.
Yeah.
About the vocal. I sometimes like that kind of vocal, but sometimes I can find it a bit wishy-washy. Although at the same time as being dramatic, it was a bit odd. I didn't quite get my head around it, I don't think.
It's weird. It's the one that does sink in after a while. I did think exactly like that. Say with the vocal thing, I think it was after a while that I sort of was getting that kind of was like, tell me when, Human League, sort of the vocal behind it.
I can hear that.
Yeah,
but she isn't from Sheffield, though, is she?
No, she's Suffolk, isn't she?
Yeah, somewhere like that. But they were kind of a weird band because they were kind of lumped in with the New Cross scene, weirdly, because they were on Angular Records compilation, along with likes of Block Party and Art Brute and that kind of early mid 2000s thing. So weirdly, they became part of that scene. Yet they were from Sheffield, so it was weird. But I kind of knew about them before because we had a writer in Sheffield at the time. And I suppose I've just got one of the connections to this song because I just remember going to a club and dancing to it as well. So that was
a funny moment for me, I think, actually, thinking about that period of time. Because there was a lot of that sort of like post-punk revival that was going on around there. And I think I was just a bit annoyed by it. I think probably going back now, I'd probably really enjoy a lot more of it more than I did at the time, because I was just kind of, it felt like the beginning of what I think we've sort of got stuck in now, which is a kind of stylistic coma.
We've talked about this before, haven't we, Jim, with the post-punk bands, the shouty post-punk bands.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, but when I think post-punk, I mean, you know, like, obviously the Talking Heads and,
yeah,
and
yeah.
Elvis Costello and you know, literally a million other things that are kind of post-punk, you know.
Yeah, it's like, what does it mean?
The Cure. you know, everything was post-punk, wasn't it? I mean, that basically 1979 to 1981 is the best period of pop music in history. So there's a lot to mine there.
Yeah.
But yeah,
it's what you do with it, isn't it?
It's what you do with it, yeah. I think I was just a bit like, you know, come on.
That's everybody. Fair enough.
I always have a bit of a, it's not snobbery, but I have a bit of a kind of push things forward kind of attitude, even though some of the things I love the most are the most simple and don't do that at all, and I'm a complete hypocrite.
No, I hear you.
We're all a bit like that. Yeah, the Long Blondes, I'll give that an 8 because I do really like the band. And yeah, I think they're sort of an unfulfilled kind of...
It's very, yeah, it's a sad story.
Yeah. I think he's doing solo things now. They're both doing solo things now. So, Jim?
Yeah, just grew on me massively. So, an 8 for me, too.
I'm going to give it a 7, and I'm not on speed.
Final cult classic this week, Tom.
The thing was, I really toyed with playing you a new track by Blake Mills, which I really like. It's really cool track called Money Is the One True God that I think is really interesting and cool. And I think that, you know, I think Blake's a bit of a chancer, but I think that he's kind of a very, very talented one. So I kind of give him for it. But I think most people probably know him as a producer now, for he's worked on loads of different things, Alabama Shakes and Christ knows what else, but he and has played with literally everybody as a session musician. He's a ridiculously talented guitar player. I first became aware of him through a band called Doors, who was signed I think to ATO in the sort of mid noughties or something, or late noughties. He's a brilliant musician, and he put out this little record in about 2009, 2010, I think, called Break Mirrors. Which is really kind of very country-ish, kind of simple country-ish record. Has a load of great songs on it, winter songs on that as well, which is really good. But It'll All Work Out is one that sort of stayed with me because it's a fantastic song lyrically.
plumber if your heat is still out. Don't be scared, I know you can still throw down. It'll all work out. It'll all work out. Now I don't feel a speck of hate. Really, no, I'm trying to get my story straight. And you called me from the car when you were on your way with your friend to San Francisco that you told me was gay. And I guess he was a closet straight. Get it all out now. It'll all work out. It'll all work out. It'll all work out, work out.
It's a brilliant thing about, you know, a kind of American life.
I did pull out a few of the lyrics on that. That really did. I did like that. Talking about his mum, she knew just how to make a quarterback smile. That was a bit of a line. And also, was it his dad stayed up all night trying to keep the checkbook tighter than a duck's ass going down a water slide? Yeah.
it's a joy for that reason. And of course, I thought, well, you know, it'll all, you know, it's a good message for the moment.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah.
Especially when America's in such turmoil and stuff. Yeah, well, I found it really good as well. I was sort of comforted by it, and I love the finger-picked guitars.
The slap sound. What,
yeah. And it reminded me of sort of that other acts that sort of do that really personal and political thing, like Willie Mason or somebody like that.
Yeah, there's sort of a southern bluegrass sort of thing to it.
Yeah, but it's kind of the way he sort of effortlessly...
He's cleverer as
personal,
well.
Personal, political... kind of lyrics, like you were talking about, they're sort of like personal, but then they tap into a wider themes. I like that. It's cool.
He knows the context in which he's doing this. That's
yeah.
He knows that he's using country to speak to you in that way. You know, it's very, very deliberate. It's a little bit cynical, but it's
quite deceptive too. Because when I first listened to it, I didn't get as many political. Or even like those kind of references. But then the second time I listened to it, then the lyrics. Yeah. Kind of, yeah.
He's a very bright boy. He's one to watch.
Yeah, it's good. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, so no, I really enjoyed it. It's all like that laconic southern bluegrass thing, but which is very different to that, because you first asked us about that. Money is the one true God, which is very different to this, isn't it? Obviously, I take it that record that this one's from, it'll all work out. That's more of a country album.
Absolutely. Yeah. The new record's like this kind of really unusual, textural, spacey thing. I want not the first person to say this, but he's kind of a natural successor to like John Bryan and people like that. He kind of, and he also works with Fiona Apple and people like that too.
Okay.
So he's kind of across the whole thing. He's a bit of a production whiz. And obviously a brilliant guitar player. He's one of those people that you'll end up, you know, everyone will end up knowing his name because if you're a muso.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I'll give that an 8 starting off with. Jim?
Yeah, no, that sounds good to me. 8.
Yeah, another 8 from me.
Cool. Yeah, that was a good way to round off the the podcast. Cheers for coming on, Tom. Where can people go if they want to get involved in Broken Music campaign, or what can they do? Because there's another one, wasn't there? What was it? Love Music.
Oh no, there's basically.
It's a bit confusing, isn't it?
It's basically the MU and the Ivors Academy have started a thing called Keep Music Alive, which is a much broader kind of campaign that covers their membership and the struggle that they've got. Whereas Broken Record is very sort of specifically about the recorded music business and targeting that. Yeah. And you know, if people are interested, the best thing they can do is just come and follow me on Twitter and talk to me and communicate with me. And
you got a big response from that thread, didn't you, that you put up?
Oh yeah, that's been, I mean, to be honest, like, but that's been mad the way this has been covered. You know, it's been, I've been on national radio about that.
Yeah, I saw that.
And I've, you know, it's been covered in most of the national newspapers. And it's quite funny what can come out of just having a little rant on Twitter on a Sunday morning or whatever it was.
Yeah, you don't know who's reading sometimes, do you? I need to be careful. Cheers for coming on, Tom. That was really interesting. Brilliant. And yeah, the tracks you brought were cool as well. So cheers.
It was a lot of fun, fellas. Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to episode 12 of Show Me Magic, God Is in the TV podcast. My name's Bill Cummings. Been with Jim Orton.
Goodbye.
And we've had Tom Gray on from the Broken Record campaign, and that bloke from Gomez, he described himself as well. Till the next time. Ta-da.
Ta-da.
You've been listening to Show Me Magic, a God Is in the TV recommend show. Check out more on godisinthetvzine.co.uk or on our Twitter page, God Is in the TV. We're also on Facebook, God Is in the TV Zine with a dot. Thanks for listening. Until the next time. Ta-da.